American taxpayers to ground control. We're getting a dial tone.
I don't think anyone's manning ground control. I think that they got shut down a long time ago.
This is Major Tom to ground control.
The shutdown says shut up to millions of American workers, and we're flying blind on the U.S. economy.
And I'm floating in the most peculiar way.
I'm John Hockenberry, and this is The Takeaway.
Stars look very different.
No government economic stats, race and politics in North Carolina, where I am today. Also, NASA's partial shutdown adds a bit of reality terror to the new movie Gravity, set in space. Thanks so much for listening. And I thought there was a chance that the shutdown would get resolved yesterday while I was out. But no. It's still shutdown week in America and Affordable Care Act week in America as well. We'll have voices from the shutdown and from the reaches of the uninsured this hour. In many ways, we're all floating out in space with needs from our government, the federal government not picking up the phone. Ground control, where exactly is ground control this week? We'll be exploring that metaphor a little bit as well with the release of the movie Gravity, which we'll also talk about later this hour. Plus, we'll have a look at a legal battle playing out here in North Carolina as the Department of Justice takes on a law in this state requiring identification at the voting booth. We begin this hour, though, with some real voices from the shutdown. It shows just how dependent the U.S. economy is on the federal government, despite all our free market ideals and rhetoric. A lot of small businesses around the country are feeling it, and we've invited some folks to talk about the economic impact they are feeling this week. With us on the line, Paul Hare, owner of Your Dog's Best Friends in Alexandria, Virginia, Phil Francis, who was recently the superintendent of the Blue Ridge Parkway in North Carolina. He's retired. And our third guest goes by the name of Own. She's the owner of Tours in the Glades in Florida City. Welcome to all three of you.
Hi, John. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for having us.
Hello, John.
All right. So, Phil Francis, let me begin with you, since you're the wide swath of the Blue Ridge Parkway. You were superintendent of the parkway for about 8 years, retired in April. What is the effect of the government shutdown on a road as important as the Blue Ridge?
Well, the Blue Ridge Parkway affects many communities, and also our employees are affected and our partners who work for us along the 469 miles that the Blue Ridge Parkway passes. We pass through 29 counties. We impact dozens of communities who really are reliant upon the tourism trade for their economic well-being. And the busiest time of year is now.
And that's because the fall colors are coming on. It's a beautiful part of the country anyway. What would you say is the interaction between the federal government and the private sector in your neck of the woods there, Phil?
Well, we have a very strong partnership. We work with many convention and visitors bureaus, many hotels, restaurants, gift shops, gas stations, police departments. We have a huge partnership.
And when that partnership is disrupted, that means a lot of people aren't picking up the phone, and the chain of information and making things work gets that much more difficult. Owner of Tours in the Glades in Florida City, Florida, how would you say this federal private sector partnership works in your world?
It's a wonderful cooperation between the parks and the private sector. It's really valued. And it's upsetting to see this happen to our parks, of course.
And when one partner doesn't show up, the federal government, what does it do specifically to your day-to-day operations?
You would not be able to enter Everglades National Park, Biscayne National Park, Big Cypress National Preserve. You just have to experience it on the peripheral. And that's one place where we are lucky. We have a lot of areas peripherally that are still beautifully preserved Everglades ecosystem, but it's just not the park. It's not what the visitors who come to see the park want.
Paul Hare in Alexandria, Virginia, tell me about the federal and private partnership from your perspective.
Well, I'm purely private. We felt the effect of the furlough immediately. We dropped by probably 25 out of 125 dogs. that come to my dog daycare and boarding facility on a regular basis every day. And so that's about $1,000 that's missing per day from my cash flow, which is about a third of my payroll.
And these are people who are home with their pets, right?
We're assuming if you're not at work, why not stay at home and play with your dog? That's about the best thing I can think of.
So and I want to ask every one of you this. Just how psychologically sort of heartbroken do you feel by the federal government? Do you feel like the federal government has just been behaving badly here, letting you down? This is needless. What's your level of frustration, Paul?
Well, I got an odd perspective in that I worked in the Senate staff at one point, and I've seen this up close and personal. I've seen them unplug the clock on the floor of the Senate while the debt ceiling limit is approached so that they don't actually technically go over it. This, to me now, makes no sense. The level of vitriol that is being tossed around here, it's infecting this entire process, and it's breaking it down. Somehow these guys have to back away from the rhetoric.
And federal workers on the Blue Ridge Parkway, they do their job. Why can't folks on Capitol Hill do theirs? Phil Francis, is that a fair assessment of your own frustration?
Well, I know our employees ask me that a lot. But I'm really also concerned not only for our employees who are out there saving lives, taking risks to serve the public, but this 2 million people come to the Parkway this time of year, spend $50 million. I'm also concerned for the businesses and our partners on the Parkway. We have motels, we have gift shops, we have restaurants. We have a significant chunk of business going on that affects hundreds and hundreds of people. And sometimes these tourist businesses operate on the margins. So any impact, especially at this time of year, it's like closing a shopping mall at Christmas time.
And Owen, give me your sense of your frustration level right now.
Well, the frustration level, when you look at the numbers, $600 million to local businesses and partners if it lasts 20 days. $30 million a day is the revenue lost. The park generates $10 to every $1 the government gives. And for the government to behave like they are, it's the equivalent of two parents having an argument of the quality of the meal they're going to give to their child, and then while they're arguing about it, just not feeding the child. It's embarrassing.
So what's the break point for you? Do you have to close down if this goes on for 3 weeks, 4 weeks?
Yeah, we've already lost $8,000, and the repercussions are huge across the board. This is going to be felt even after the parks reopen.
Paul Hare, owner of Your Dog's Best Friends in Alexandria, Virginia, what's your break point?
Well, I don't really have one, not a break point. We keep a good chunk of money in the bank for contingencies like these. So put it this way, the country's going to break long before my company does.
That's not our case.
That makes me feel good. Phil Francis, final thoughts.
Well, you know, I was talking to one of our businesses that operates inside of Great Smoky Mountains National Park, where I also worked and was there during the last shutdown. They're losing $40,000 every day. This is their busiest time of year. We've got to reopen.
That's miserable. Well, Phil, good luck to you.
Thank you.
And Owen, I hope the spring break works a little better for you than the fall is right now.
I hope so, too. I hope they get them open ASAP.
And, Paul Hare, we got to get those dogs and cats back.
Yes, we do. We're going to get them in and have some fun.
Paul Hare, owner of Your Dog's Best Friends in Alexandria, Virginia. And we also spoke with Phil Francis, former superintendent of the Blue Ridge Parkway in North Carolina, and owner of Tours in the Glades in Florida City, Florida. Thanks to the three of you, and good luck.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
We would normally today be telling you the latest government jobs report for the month of September, but nope. The survey couldn't be completed. The Labor Department shut down. We don't know the unemployment rate in the U.S. economy or the payroll numbers. And if this shutdown goes on, we won't know the trade deficit, the CPI inflation rate, the GDP, PPI, all those adorable little acronyms that are supposed to tell us what's going on in the economy. Now, besides our small business friends who we just spoke with who are suffering, are those 800,000 federal workers furloughed this week, including the janitorial staff at the Capitol? John Boehner and Harry Reid have to figure out how to clean their own offices on their own, apparently. You are
the best part of me, the best that I am or ever will be.
But we wanted to give you a little scale of what the relationship between the federal government and the U.S. economy actually is in this shutdown week. In many ways, the federal government is one of the best parts of the U.S. economy. The shutdown back in 1995 cost about $1.5 billion for 22 days. This time around, it's estimated to be $1.6 billion a week. NBC News estimates $12.5 million per hour, $300 million per day. Those numbers, frightening. But consider this. You've still got $357 billion in federal contracts being paid, $495 billion in federal grants, direct payments like Social Security and food stamps, $935 billion, $151 billion in insurance, $176 billion in loan guarantees, and $6.2 billion. That's just miscellaneous. And that doesn't even count the money the Federal Reserve is still pumping into the economy at the rate of $85 billion per month. It's all happening. A couple of trillion.
You're the best part of me.
Best part of the U.S. economy?
Yes, you are.
Well, let's hope that federal support is not going anywhere.
The best part of me.
Forget money and dollars. What about people? You know, the federal shutdown has created this divide in the huge federal workforce, essential workers versus non-essential workers. One of the ironies yesterday was that some of the police officers involved in that terrifying and tragic incident with the car and the cops in Washington, D.C., were actually working without pay because of the shutdown. I guess they were essential and non-essential yesterday during the lockdown around the Capitol. But what a badge to wear. Non-essential. What does that mean? You shouldn't exist? We'd be better off without you. You're a physical evidence of waste in government, as some of our listeners have suggested. The shutdown shows what we don't need in our federal government. Well, non-essential does not mean non-important. High-level employees in all branches of government, from the West Wing of the White House to Congress, the statisticians at the Labor Department, they're furloughed because of the shutdown, and they're important. How's your self-esteem in this shutdown week? Are you thinking about your own job a little differently? Any stories out there?
Hi, this is Sheila Vasquez from Charlotte, North Carolina. As a teacher, I feel that we are constantly, you know, made to believe that our jobs are not important by the way we are treated in schools, the things that, you know, we are not provided that we have to provide to make sure our students have the education that they deserve.
Yeah, my name is John Martin. I'm a police officer in Louisville, Kentucky, and I consider my job essential, though I realize that there are some members of the community that don't feel that way.
John, Sheila, thanks so much. You know, this goes everywhere in the economy, public and private sector.
Hi, this is Trixie. Some people think that I don't have a real job because I'm a self-employed antique dealer. But my work is important to me, and I simply don't allow anybody to treat it as unimportant. I treat it with seriousness and respect, and I tend to receive that in return.
That's the spirit, Trixie. We got this from Portland, Oregon. If you own a vehicle, my job is essential. I own an auto shop, and vehicles have a tendency to break. There you go. Dallas, Texas. I work for a nonprofit trying to raise money to cure a chronic disease. I don't think any economist would call me essential, but when I interact with kids suffering from this disease, I feel more than necessary. We want to hear you crow about your job. Tell us. What's essential about what you do? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Give us a story. You can always find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
Listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Hey, The Takeaway this week from WFAE 90.7 in Charlotte, North Carolina. And this week, the United States Department of Justice sued the state of North Carolina over that state's new voting law, which requires voters to use special government IDs, cuts back on early voting, and eliminates same-day voter registration. The Justice Department says the law is discriminatory. It has a disproportionate impact, according to the DOJ, on the poor, elderly, and minority citizens. Back in June, you'll recall, the Supreme Court invalidated a key provision of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, making certain places more free to enact changes in voting procedures without federal pre-clearance approval. Joining me now is Michael Tomczyk, reporter for WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina, and Kareem Creighton, a professor of law at the University of North Carolina Law School. Professor, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And Michael, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with you, Michael. Is this law an example, as we've seen in other states, of a kind of pent-up demand in certain places to enact changes in voting laws that the Supreme Court suddenly opened the floodgates to and boom, suddenly this is in place?
In our state, the timeline certainly makes it seem like that's the case. So the North Carolina House originally passed a bill that was really – it was only 15 pages and focused on just photo ID. That was back in late April. The Senate did nothing with it until after the Supreme Court decision. Then about a month after the Supreme Court decision, all of a sudden the Senate introduces a substitute that is nearly 50 pages long, includes all of these things that the Justice Department has filed suit against, and was really a much larger – just kind of total take on voting as opposed to this concentrated change that was before the Supreme Court decision.
So if you're a voter in North Carolina, all of a sudden you have to consider a bunch of things that you never did before. Give me a sense of that.
One of the things that will impact the most people would be the cuts to early voting. So the midterm elections in 2014, you have a maximum of 10 days of early voting as opposed to 17 in the last presidential election. To give you some perspective, about a fifth of all North Carolina voters who cast ballots in the last presidential election voted during that first week of early voting. Mm. So the Republicans behind the bill say local boards of elections still have to offer the same total hours of early voting, but you've got seven fewer days to work with. So the Republican argument is that this will still, we think this may shorten lines, but clearly the Department of Justice disagrees.
And before we go to Professor Creighton here on this and the question of where this lawsuit goes, it's always the case that the political discourse on the surface about this is we're just trying to reform voting and make things easier, blah, 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 blah. And of course, that's the case. Yes. But there's a political backstory here. What is it in North Carolina?
Well, the pent-up demand is part of it. I mean, in North Carolina, Republicans are in power. We've got a Republican in charge of the governor's mansion and the state legislature for the first time in more than 100 years. And a lot of the policies that our state legislature has passed over the past year are hallmark Republican policies. It's fundamental things that these guys and girls run on, from photo ID on. What's interesting about this voting bill, no one ran on let's cut early voting. Let's throw out ballots that are accidentally cast at the wrong precinct.
Early voters, Democrats? Tardy voters, Republicans? Is that how it works?
Well, I mean, if you look at the numbers, actually, in the last presidential election, Republicans made gains in early voting in North Carolina. So it's actually...
Professor Creighton, let's talk about the lawsuit. The preclearance issue under the Voting Rights Act until the Supreme Court decision put the burden of proof on districts to show that their laws weren't having an impact on abridging voting rights among certain constituencies. That's reversed now, right?
Well, it effectively has been rendered inert by the Supreme Court's invalidation of the formula used to direct this sort of rule that you just described to the states.
And the Department of Justice really has a hard slope to climb here.
Well, they have the typical slope that any plaintiff has to bring to court by proving that the likely effect of the plan is one that has basically a disparate impact on minority groups. And based on the information that the state itself developed in the course of adopting the plan, there definitely is some evidence that African Americans in North Carolina are more likely to be affected by this rule than other members of the North Carolina electorate. And the question is how much is enough and whether or not the state has offered alternatives to get around some of these inherent disparities.
Does DOJ have to argue? And of course, it's up to them what to argue, not up to us necessarily. But is it sufficient for DOJ to argue there are lots of elderly people and African Americans who don't have IDs, so therefore this is discriminatory? Or do they also have to say, and it would be really hard for them to get IDs, and here's why?
Right. And that actually, the second part that you mentioned really is the rub. If you look at instances where DOJ in other contexts under Section 5 really has challenged the use of these rules, the real question that the courts sort of fall on is, are there alternatives to resolve some of these disparities that occur. And, of course, the state in all of these cases says, well, yeah, of course, we've done enough. And that's really going to be the rub. Is it enough to say that there are alternative, for example, for voter ID requirements, are there alternative methods of showing that you are who you claim to be, or maybe free methods of obtaining some of the documents that cost money that allow people who tend not to have those documents to get them easily?
Will there be alternatives in North Carolina? Is there any precedent for those alternatives being sufficient?
Well, you have to take into account both, I think, the level of severity in the requirement. And North Carolina clearly is at the top of the list in terms of the severe limitations. Even state-held university IDs that are photo IDs don't count under their standard. Mm. And so you balance that against the different ways in which maybe people who don't have it can get the ID. And again, we don't really have a great guide, but we do have in other circumstances less severe voter ID requirements in different contexts being seen as maybe not
right.
Commensurate with the alternatives available.
Professor Creighton, thanks so much.
Sure. Happy to be with you.
Graham Creighton is a professor of law at the University of North Carolina Law School. Michael Tomczyk, before we go, is this lawsuit popular, unpopular in North Carolina, federal government meddling?
I think it falls down on party lines. Republicans say it's a waste of taxpayer money. The Democrats say this is overdue and this is necessary.
The Department of Justice suing North Carolina over the state's new voting law with lots of restrictions, including special government IDs. Michael Tomczyk is a reporter for WFAE right here in Charlotte, North Carolina, where the takeaway is. Michael, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I'm Spartacus! I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus!
No more! Hang on!
I'm trying to use the phone!
It's Movie Friday. As always, our Movie Day team, Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer are here. Rafer, Kristen, I'm in Charlotte. You're in New York. How you doing?
How are the Carolinas?
They're great. Rafer Guzman, of course, film critic for Newsday. Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway. And both of them constitute the Movie Date podcast, which you can subscribe to at moviedatepodcast.org. So, guys, this week, it's all about floating out in space for a whole variety of reasons, including the release of Gravity. Yes? How exciting is that?
It's pretty exciting.
Very. All right. Hold your opinion for a moment. Let's get a clip in. It's George Clooney, Sandra Bullock, floating out in space with limited options, kind of the way we all feel this week. Listen.
Houston, Explorer, copy. Explorer, Dr. Stone requesting faster transport to Bay Area. Explorer, do you copy?
Explorer, permission to retrieve Dr. Stone.
Here go for it. We've lost Houston.
We've lost Houston. The theme here is Houston, we have a really big problem. Kristen, what did you think?
It's a huge problem, yes. We have two astronauts in space, played by Sandra Bullock and George Clooney. Their spacecraft is damaged, and they are untethered, floating off into space in their spacesuits, trying to survive and find their way back to Earth. And I just have to say, it is a movie that's trying to do something very difficult, have it both ways, be both interesting and smart and artistic, and be a big Hollywood blockbuster. And for the most part, it succeeds. I have to say, I was on the edge of my seat the whole time. It was visually spectacular. I was so tense. The acting was great. And I couldn't believe how immersive the world was that they created, not just visually, but physically you feel it. And I have to warn people, you might get motion sick watching this movie. It's very immersive. You feel like you're out there with them the whole time.
So it really sort of harkens back to the sense of physical isolation and all the sort of questions of identity and how we are tethered to the Earth as human beings that comes from Kubrick's 2001. Does it succeed, Rafer?
It does in some respects. There are definitely some very clear nods to those heavy themes of birth and evolution that you saw in 2001. I have to agree with Kristen. This movie is like just a visual stunner. It's like one of the most incredible things you will ever see. Thematically and emotionally, it left me just a little bit cold, and I was a little disappointed by that. But there's no denying that it's an incredibly wild ride. It's the special effects are the real star of the film, and they will really knock your socks off.
Cold, that's what space is all about. Runner, Runner is our next offering. Justin Timberlake, a student from Princeton University who, well, has all kinds of problems. Listen to the clip.
I think that ends our business here. Unless, of course, I feel like sticking around and taking a shot at a real business. Guaranteed 7 figures in the first 18 months. Guaranteed 8 figures in the first 3 years. So what do you say? Is it Newark? Will you stick around here with me?
Last time Timberlake got a business proposition was in The Social Network. Radio Rafer, he's getting one from Ben Affleck. What'd you think of this?
Yeah, this is trying to combine the Social Network with Wall Street. The plot is identical. Young whiz kid falls under the prey, under the spell of a ruthless empire builder. I think it wants to be very timely and topical. It's all about online gambling and technology. It doesn't really work. The story's a bit of a mess, but it is kind of fun to see Affleck countercast as a charming villain type. That's not something you see him do much. That's kind of fun.
All right, the Rafer and Kristen, what's up on the podcast this week?
Well, it's our annual speed date. We're going to do 10 movies in 10 minutes and talk about Gravity in more detail.
All right, the Movie Date Podcast you can subscribe to at moviedatepodcast.org. Rafer Guzman, Kristen Meinzer, Rafer, news critic at Newsday, Kristen, culture producer for us. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you, John.
Ground control to Major Tom. Commencing countdown, engines on.
So let's further explore our metaphor of the day, floating out in space, out of contact, out of options, waiting for some kind of breakpoint, like in the movie Gravity. Eric Sofci has extensively researched spacesuits and survival. He's a contributing writer to Popular Science, specializing in space science and technology. Eric Sofci, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, you know, we have this really strong sense of a metaphor, and we're getting a stronger sense of it from this movie Gravity. Of, you know, what it's like to be, you know, in a spacesuit kind of floating out in space above Earth, unable to kind of communicate with ground control or whatever. What's it really like in engineering terms? What are the real plans for dealing with a situation like that?
Well, NASA actually technically calls it going overboard, you know, if you are sort of out there adrift in space and you aren't hooked on anymore. To a structure like the space station. And it's actually pretty grim, because if that happens, that means that a lot of things have gone wrong. Your tethers that you have hooked up to at least 2 points at all times have broken for some reason, or, you know, become unclipped. And it means that your jetpack that all astronauts have on their suits if they're doing any kind of a spacewalk has also run out of fuel, or it's, you know, disabled for some reason. And at that point, it's pretty grim. You have, at the moment, no options really for survival. You pretty much just have to wait, I guess, make your last goodbyes to mission control.
If your radio's even working. And, you know, flapping right around isn't going to help, because it's a vacuum, right?
That's true, yeah. I mean, that's why ultimately you want to have that tether attached at all times. And then if that fails for some reason, you need to activate your jetpack, which essentially has – it's hard to say how long you can really use it for. It's not a lot of fuel in there. One thing that's excellent about it, which is a little different from what happens in the movie, is it actually automatically stabilizes you. So if you're tumbling – you basically hit a button, and on its own, your jetpack will right you, which is very useful. And then you can try to thrust towards some kind of safety, if there is any safety. But it's not a lot of wiggle room. It's not like a spaceship.
And how much oxygen is there in a spacesuit? Is it hours, days?
No, at maximum, maybe it might be 8 hours, maybe a little bit more. It depends on if you can sort of regulate your breathing. And NASA, they did mention that this is a thing that you drill for, which is kind of, you know, kind of terrifying. But for this notion of being overboard and how to sort of calm yourself and, you know, maybe wait for rescue. Although at this point, you know, with the technology we have, there's really no one who can pick you up.
And what about the pressurization? Is that dependent on batteries or some system?
No. That's actually all sort of passively handled in the suit. And so, I mean, that's why ultimately, I mean, it's not, you know, a nice way to go, but it's not like you're all of a sudden going to have like an, you know, explosive depressurization or freeze or something, unless you were to, you know, decide to pop off your helmet or, you know, something really drastic. But no, you essentially just run out of air, you know, because you're going to run out of air before you run out of water. You actually usually have a little bit of water, like maybe up to a liter that you can drink from a straw. And you don't really have any food anymore. For a brief period, they used to have this kind of food log. I mean, it didn't sound very appetizing.
Is gravity realistic here?
I would say so to a really astonishing degree. I mean, again, you know, there's a couple of quibbles. Like I mentioned, that notion of Bullock kind of goes out of control and is tumbling for a while. Again, that's the kind of thing that you would handle with your jetpack sort of instantly. But overall, I mean, this is it's really, really, really impressively realistic in terms of the orbital mechanics. You know, what happens if you're in this type of a sort of collision in space, even, you know, the lack of audio almost as far as hearing sort of all that destruction. Really, really impressive. I mean, this is, I think, the most realistic space movie since, you know, Apollo 13.
Eric Sofci is a contributing writer to Popular Science, specializing in space science and technology. Thanks so much.
Excellent. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
We are going to finish out this hour with a look at a group of people the government is attempting to reach, people who have been out of reach for a long time, the uninsured. The Affordable Care Act this week begins implementation of the insurance marketplaces for consumers. Also, states are extending Medicaid to bring more people under federal coverage in that program. But it differs from state to state, as we've told you many times. And we're going to hear from the uninsured who have not yet been reached in the state of California in a moment. But first, one voice from Ohio who can feel that help is within reach for her, but who today feels definitely cut off from ground control.
I don't think anyone's manning ground control. I think that they got shut down a long time ago.
That's Takeaway listener and Athens, Ohio resident Amy Farnsworth. If it was up to the feds, even in this government shutdown situation, her family with some difficult health problems would be eligible for the Medicaid extension. Except her state, Ohio, with its Republican-controlled legislature, has opted out of the extension, despite urging from Republican Governor John Kasich. Amy Farnsworth says she's out of luck, out of time, and out of options.
The Affordable Care Act originally required the states to expand Medicaid, and the Supreme Court said that it was up to the individual states. It was their choice. Ohio is one of the 26 states which chose not to. My husband is a totally disabled Vietnam combat vet. My son is autistic. My son is on Medicaid. My husband gets his health care through the VA. Because his disabilities that are non-service connected are more than his service-connected disabilities, he is on what is called a VA pension, which is need-based. They pay exactly the amount of the federal poverty level, which means that while I care for my son and my husband and am the only person who can take them to their appointments, which are about 2 hours away for each of them, I cannot take advantage of the Affordable Care Act because we don't make enough money, and we make too much money for me to qualify for Ohio Medicaid because they did not expand the Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act.
Now, you qualify for Medicaid if the expansion goes into place, but right now you don't qualify because you're right there at the border, and I understand you're a caregiver. And you have an ally here, the Republican governor. He actually believes that you should get that coverage and this expansion should go forward, right?
Yes, he does. Right now, the cutoff for Ohio Medicaid is 90% of the federal income level, and we make exactly 100%.
Of the poverty level?
Yes.
Wow. Yeah, you're rich, right? Yeah, you're just rolling in it there. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So here's another war between Republicans in your state that's basically shutting you down on something that in the law of the land, it says you're entitled to.
Yes. I've talked to my congressman, both state and federal. I've talked to the governor. I've talked to all of them. And basically, thanks for hearing your input. We'll get back with you.
Amy, in very serious terms here, what are your health breakpoints? I suspect that your autistic son is stable, even though he requires a lot of care. What about your husband?
He is a lot more fragile, very prone to infections and falls and such. But he is not bad enough for me to qualify as a caregiver under the VA definition. Basically, I can't qualify for that until he's ready to go into a nursing home.
And anything you could do, change the paperwork, change your status in some way to put you into qualification?
The only way for me to do that would be if we got divorced legally.
Have you talked about that?
Yes, several times.
And you're not having problems in your marriage?
No, but under his VA pension, since it is need-based, if I go out and somehow get a part-time job that I can work around their schedules, their appointments, say I make $1,000 gross, I would only bring home about $700 after taxes and everything else. They would take the full $1,000 out of his check. If we divorced, I would be able to work and not have it taken out of his check, and I would be able to afford health coverage.
So that's the message from the Ohio legislature. Get a divorce and call us back.
Yeah. That's about the only option that I have.
Well, Amy, why did you reach out to us? Why do you think Americans need to hear this story?
They're hearing right now all of the stories about people getting coverage for the first time or the first time in a long time under the Affordable Care Act. And I thought that they needed to hear about the ones who fell through this big crack that's opened up because of the ruling of the Supreme Court.
And, of course, the legislators in your state would say, we don't want the federal government meddling in our state and forcing us to pay for things that we can't afford. And you say to them?
What they told me yesterday was that there were some big problems with the Medicaid program, and they considered expanding Medicaid to be throwing good money after bad. And my message to them is, helping someone who's taking care of two other people is not throwing good money after bad. It's helping me help others.
Is there a name of someone who actually said to you it would be throwing good money after bad?
It was my state representative's, the person who answers the phone there. He didn't give a name.
Your state representative's staff member said it would be throwing good money after bad to help you out.
Yes.
And
that until
that person,
Medicaid was fixed at the federal level, which, of course, they can't do anything about.
Right.
So it's not on them. That it would be throwing good money after bad.
So, Amy, I know you've got a busy day, and I want to let you go, but thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much for listening.
It's Takeaway listener and Athens, Ohio resident Amy Farnsworth. We reached out to Governor Kasich's office last week and got this response from his staff. We're knee-deep in discussions with the legislature on expansion right now, and accordingly, there is next to nothing we can say about it publicly. When we get expansion done, let's regroup. But in the interim, we just don't have much to talk about. Well, that's an improvement over good money after bad. We'll keep working on this for you, Amy. Stay with us. If there's a useful metaphor for what is happening in the U.S. government this week, floating out in space, trying to get someone on the line might work here. Imagine the millions of uninsured Americans out in near-Earth orbit and the government trying to connect with them to get them to start making rational health choices.
The paramedics came, yeah, and then they were going to charge me for the hospital ride. And at the time, I didn't have insurance because I was an SAN, and I said, nope, I'm just going to call my family. So I went home with the broken ankle.
That's a woman with a fractured ankle who won't get in an ambulance because she has no insurance. It's the challenge of the Affordable Care Act, reaching uninsured people like Cheryl Paul there, getting them into the insurance pool after years of being out there in limbo. Here's her full story.
May 27th, holiday, I was headed out with my youngest son to go to the movies, and I was a passenger in the vehicle. And next thing I know, I look up and I see truck, big black truck. So the paramedics came,
right,
and then came to see you the next day.
You didn't have any splint on it or
nothing.
Anything. It was just a loose, broken ankle.
Yes. Okay. I just hobbled.
Gotcha.
And
gotcha.
Decided to go to Highland the next day.
Highland Hospital Emergency Room in Oakland, California is what she's talking about. Cheryl Paul and others like her have already been reached by a unique collaboration between the StoryCorps Project and filmmaker Peter Nix, the director of the documentary The Waiting Room. Nix has also created a social media project that follows the life and times of patients and staff at Highland Hospital in Oakland, California. Nix and StoryCorps are creating a record of these people's needs and experiences. People like Warren Steptor, who uses the ER at Highland as his only doctor. Insurance scares him.
You never really think about health care until you're actually sick. And I was quite amazed with the care at Highland Hospital for someone who had no health care insurance, and the way things were, you know, presented to me. I was handled with professional care. I was surprised.
Now, what if your alternative to Highland Hospital was buying insurance or getting on a program to get subsidized, federally financed insurance to keep you from going to the emergency room all the time? Would you be interested in that sort of program?
Well, if it's affordable, yes. Health care is quite exorbitant these days, so anything that's going to make my life easier, I'm all for.
Pete Nix, is it interesting as a documentarian that we live in a nation where people, and Warren just sort of suggested this here, where people are more afraid of insurance than they are of going to something like an emergency room, which actually sounds pretty scary to me?
Well, the interesting thing that we found was that Warren represents, you know, an entire community that basically the default for them became, as their primary care physician, was the waiting room. The waiting room became their doctor. And I think for a lot of people, it's preferable waiting than to get a bill. This doesn't mean that you don't go to Highland and not get a bill. I mean, you go through the process, they evaluate your finances, and if you can afford it, if you fall within a certain income range, you will get a bill. But for a lot of people, I think that, you know, is preferable than, you know, having to sign up for, you know, an insurance plan where you know you're going to have a monthly payment and this is going to be part of your budget, you know, as opposed to just waiting till you get sick to have to go to the waiting room.
But Warren, doesn't it make sense to invest, kind of pay as you go on your own health rather than wait for some sort of catastrophe?
Yes, it does. But with me, when it comes to health care, I've always, you know, run and grab an aspirin. I ask them to make it go away. And until, I guess, I'm down on all, you know, hands and knees crawling, you know, then it's time to make a decision. Okay, I guess it's time to go to that emergency room, and we'll deal with it as, you know, as it comes up. it's a frightening experience. It's a frightening thought. And we tend to put our health care, you know, on the back burner, so to speak.
And for you, having lost your job, right?
Mm-hmm.
What was your most frightening moment, most dependent, feeling vulnerable moment in this whole period of being uninsured and unemployed at the same time?
I guess November 13th when I had a heart attack and found myself lying on a stretcher, you know, at Highland Hospital, basically, you know, seeing over at least 40 doctors, and I'm just wondering, how's this going to get paid for?
How did it?
Taxpayers, Medi-Cal, and some out-of-pocket expenses, but I'm just grateful to be here.
Pete Nix, how do you think health care complicates people's family life and the big sort of life and death decisions that they have to make as they go through the process of aging and dealing with dependence? And in many ways, everything goes through health care.
Well, what we found, at least what I discovered early on in spending time in the waiting room, was that our project wasn't necessarily a project about healthcare. It was a project about a community, and healthcare is interwoven in so many aspects of our lives. You know, whether it's the economy, or whether it's mental health, or whether it's, you know, violence in the streets, or education, healthcare plays such a significant role. And what happens is that when a community faces so many challenges on so many fronts, the health, the sort of primary health, gets pushed kind of to the back burner. So if it's a choice between going to the doctor and going to that job interview, well, you're going to, you know, choose that job interview. And a lot of the patients have to wait months just to get a clinic appointment. If that appointment happens to fall on the day that they have to be at work, well, they're not going to be able to make that appointment. So it's really about providing, you know, access in a reasonable way where people can take preventative measures as opposed to waiting until the last minute, because there are so many other issues that people are dealing with, primarily, you know, in Oakland, and people who come to Highland, the economy right now. It's still a struggle, and, you know, Warren, I'm sure it's the same for you, that people are still struggling to find jobs, to keep jobs, to pay mortgages, you know, to pay that rent. And so, you know, you need a healthcare system that is going to allow and complement the many challenges that they're facing on a day-to-day basis.
So, Warren, are you working with Annette now? Do you feel better now that you're covered?
Yeah, like I said, take some of the stress off, take some of the edge off of how do I do this? How do I take care of this? You know, am I going to get a large, scary bill in the mail? And then when I do, I open it up and say, oh, my God, what do I do now? So that has been alleviated, and it relieves some of the stress. So it makes it easier to sleep at night.
Well, we're grateful that you're feeling so well and doing so well. Warren Steptoe, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Pete Nix, thanks to you.
Thanks, John.
Peter Nix is the director of The Waiting Room, a documentary film and social media project that follows the life and times of patients at Highland Hospital, Oakland, California. Warren Steptoe is a car mechanic in Oakland who spent long stretches of his life uninsured. His story will be saved in the Library of Congress thanks to a collaboration between StoryCorps and The Waiting Room.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're floating in space.
Conversation with the uninsured people the Affordable Care Act is going to have to reach to succeed. Thanks so much for listening here in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thanks to our friends at WFAE 90.7, the Carolinas, where we've got 8 local preschool Head Start centers serving more than 800 kids, shutting down today because of the federal impasse in Washington. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend, everyone. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.